Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 351st episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Daniel Rhodes, Simon L. Smith, and Ryan Lagod. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Louisa Vick on the show. She is an agent at WPA, which is an agency that represents department heads, directors, cinematographers, editors, those sorts of people, our people, right? And so we have a really great conversation with her. She is mostly on the feature side, so we talk mostly about the way that she guides her clients through the act of picking what projects to do, you know, how to figure out what their career is going to ultimately look like and shape that to be something long and fruitful and special. And we dig in to talk to her about how directors like us can work with clients like hers.
Yeah, and her client list is like A list. She represents like Larkin Siple, who shot Everything Everywhere All at Once, Shane Hurlbut, who shot Terminator Salvation and does a ton of like film education stuff. Her client shot Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and War of the Planet of the Apes and District 9 and mm-hmm. Smile and Emily mm-hmm. the Criminal and all these other things. Kong, Skull Island, Super 8, 300, and Natalie Kingston, who shot Blackbird. Remember we had the showrunner on the podcast. Really awesome clients. And to me, like the main thrust behind this interview was like, hey, how can someone like us get to work with clients like yours? You know, she has like amazing production designers, amazing line producers, amazing editors on her roster. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are editors and production designers and cinematographers, as well as directors. And so I think she gives some interesting insight, both from the viewpoint of her clients and like, you know, how she's a resource as an agent, and also for directors and filmmakers, us just getting, you know, a real nuts and bolts idea of how to work with, you know, like the cinematographer of Terminator Salvation.
You know, I think it's really a well-timed interview for us personally as well, because Oren, I think that you in particular are on a crusade right now to stop thinking small. And one of the things that I think filmmakers often will do is they'll go to their collaborators that are familiar, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. I think if you look at, say, Larkin Siple's resume, it's a lot of the same directors over and over and over again. And as we talk about in the interview, that's a very fruitful, essential part of everyone's creative journey and career. That being said, it's easy to think, oh, this person is whose work I admire or who would be perfect for this job. It's easy to think that, oh, they're too busy. Oh, they're too expensive. Oh, they're too big for this job. That used to be the case. When you start out, that's probably true, right? You know, your first $50,000 commercial or your sketch for a funny internet website or, you know, whatever. But at a certain point, you need to stop thinking like that. As your budgets get bigger and your work gets more prestigious and you're doing national broadcast spots and movies and TV shows and stuff, you should bring those collaborators along with you. But they're going to get busy and you're going to need additional people to work with. And so thinking small is a thing that sometimes can get in the way of our success. I know that you have explicitly been like, I'm going to go for it. I think that that attitude, that philosophy informed this decision. So if you want to go for it, if you want to reach for the stars and work with that DP that you constantly are pulling their stills from their work to put in your lookbooks, you can reach out to them. And we talk about that and how to do it in this episode.
I hope you enjoy the conversation. Before we talk to Louisa,
patreon.com/justshootapod is the perfect place to gift yourself a little bit of film education by subscribing at any of our patronage levels, which keeps the show going. You guys know the deal.
Give money to people that you don't know for no reason.
Yeah, have you heard of a parasocial relationship? That's when you think you know someone. It feels like you know someone, but you don't know them, but you basically know them through the internet or something. So like the way you feel about Conan
like
O'Brien.
Conan O'Brien. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think podcasting.
I did meet him once.
Well, by meet him,
I mean I was in a crowd full of college students watching him make fun of my English professor at UCLA.
Yeah, that's not meeting him. Anyway, if you feel like you know us, you want to buy us a cup of coffee, or you want to help out Editor Noah, we got some fun stuff coming up in 2023. Going to make it happen. I'm feeling optimistic about this year, and pledge now.
This is probably the longest Patreon plug we've ever made, and it does sound like an NPR.
I'm trying to conjure my PBS phone bank pledge drive youth.
Do you ever listen to a podcast and you like hit skip forward 30 seconds to get past the ads and like you're still
you're like,
in an ad?
Still in
the ad.
Well, stay tuned to Yanni Live the Acropolis, your local PBS station.
Now the references are beyond me.
Anyway, patreon.com/justshootapod. So without further delay, let's hop into our conversation with Louisa Vick.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We're here with Louisa Vick. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So you are an agent. We said you're a below the line agent, which is a term that we don't love, but it's an industry standard term, right? Can you tell us a little bit about what you do, like what a below the line agent does?
I'm an agent and partner and co-head of features at WPA. What a below the line agent does is... In a nutshell, obviously, we're looking for new opportunities for clients. We're negotiating contracts. We're doing a lot of, I would say, the standard things that agents do. I think what excites me and I think us as a team and I think also what separates us is kind of the intangible, which is the day-to-day conversations we have clients about what is the right opportunity to take at any given moment, providing guidance and advice about, again, the decision making, as well as being there to support them if there's issues on set, if there's other things that come up, both personally and professionally, that we can help the client navigate. So you know, in broad strokes, obviously we're looking for opportunities for clients, bringing them to them and negotiating contracts. But the intangible, I think, is really important, which is, again, having that kind of dialogue with the client and helping them guide their career. And the goal is to hope that they create fulfilling careers that they're going to look back on and be proud of.
That's cool. Yeah, it's funny because I think of, as a director, you know, you hear about them having like agents, managers, mm-hmm. and lawyers. But all the cinematographers and the production designers I know, they mainly only have agents. And it kind of sounds like from your description, you kind of cover like agent and what a manager would do, you know, in terms of like career guidance.
A little bit of a lawyer too, even, right? Like when you get into contract, right?
You're exactly right. So it's a little bit of everything. And again, the managerial approach is very much part of our WPA culture. And I think something that we all collectively sought out in terms of when we all came together, that was a really important component to us. It wasn't just about, you know, booking clients and moving on to the next. It was really about formulating relationships with clients where we feel like we can provide guidance and really help clients shape their careers. So that's always been very important to all of us as a collective. And then, of course, there's other components of, you know, you're also acting as a lawyer to reviewing contracts, making comments, things like that. And handling all the negotiations. So we're wearing, I would say, multiple hats at any given moment. Sometimes we're even a bit of a therapist. It's a job that I think encompasses a lot of different things. And I think as an agent, I think it is important to have, I would say, a humane approach. At least that's, I think, something that's, you know, important to me and also to my colleagues, because I think in this industry, especially when there is there's so many transactions happening, I think when you approach things from more of a humane standpoint, I think people respond to that. And that's what creates long-lasting relationships, not only mm-hmm. between agents and clients, but also between, you know, agents and also buyers too, because they trust us that, you know, if we're sending somebody to them, that they know that they're someone that we like and also feel passionate about, and they're going to be respectful human beings. So I think that's a big component. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So when you say humane, you mean it's about just being personable, basically.
Exactly. Like, yeah. It's about being personable and approaching things from like a fair, respectful way. Mm-hmm. I think agents over a course of obviously many, many years, decades, sometimes have a reputation of being a bit of a car salesman mm-hmm. type of a personality. And I think our approach has always been approaching things from a more personable, thoughtful kind of manner.
I think it's funny from our perspective sometimes, like as directors, you know, when we talk to like our DP friends that are recently repped by someone like you or something, you know, mm-hmm. And we text them and we're like, hey, I have a shoot coming up on, you know, next month, are you available? And they're like, just contact my agent. Like sometimes the agent does feel kind of a little bit like the adversary, because it seems like it instantly makes it from a personal relationship to like a business relationship, you know. You know, I've been on the flip side where I've been, you know, I'm going to work on a car commercial or something, and, you know, I need a DP that's really good with cars. And so like our producer will contact someone like you and say like, hey, we need this type of cinematographer, you know, or this type of editor, this type of line producer or whatever. And then it's like you become like a huge resource for the director. You know, let's say I want to shoot a commercial and I wonder if Larkin Seipel would shoot my commercial. And I contact you to see if he's available. Like, how much context do you need to know about the project before you check with him? And how does that work? Do you just text him and say, hey, Larkin, are you available this week in March? Or I just did a project recently with like a cinematographer that I kind of like considered out of my league. But then, you know, we just called his agent and it ended up working out, you know? And so I just kind of want to give some insight to our listeners that aren't the Daniels, you know, that aren't making a Marvel movie, like how realistic it is for them to get a client, like the realistic answer.
Yeah, the realistic answer. Yeah.
It obviously depends on what you're working on, of course, like whether Larkin would be, you know, available or whatnot. And also like whether what you're working on is in line with his sensibility. So, and that's, you know, a very big component. We're talking to clients about what is it they want to do next. You know, Larkin's a good example of, you know, he goes back and forth between commercials and film and television at times. So it really depends, like, A, you know, what he's looking to do next. How does that line up with what you're working on?
Is his team making the decision whether you pass something along, or does everything always get passed through to him and you say, hey, we don't think this is right for you, but as a heads up? An in-demand DP, for instance, can't be inundated with every single request that comes through. So I'm curious about,
like, 10 features a week.
Well, like, what's the threshold, basically? Is it just a judgment call from everyone on the team?
It's a team conversation, as far as like we are always as a team in the know of things that are coming his way, as well as like things that we're bringing to him and discussing. And we do let him know about things that come in. We let all of our clients know anytime there's a direct inquiry about the client. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, it is the client's choice whether or not to want to meet on the project, you know, consider shooting it. But we give insight and point of view to the client as far as like our thoughts on it, but ultimately it is their decision. So that's, you know, how we work with all of our clients.
Let me ask you a personal question. You come up with a DP, right? Or with any crew member, you know, you work together, you're doing all sorts of, you went to film school together, you kind of work your way up. And then at a certain point, it feels like, oh, maybe they're telling me to talk to their agent because they don't want to say no, because they want to preserve our friendship. Have you ever had a circumstance where a client has been like, Louisa, you got to take the bullet for me on this one. Tell him I'm busy. I love him, but I don't want to do this project. I don't. Does that sort of stuff happen? Is that part of the job, basically?
It does happen, yes. And it is part of the job. There is an art to saying no, and how you say no is important. Everyone's career path is different. And we talk about this a lot. Also, clients' desires, aspirations, goals change. And so there are times where people's collaborations sort of deviate. You know, you start out with working with certain directors, and then for whatever reason, like either the director made, you know, a different choice on a project and didn't work with that DP, or perhaps, you know, the DP is looking to do something different than he's done on the last, you know, four or five movies. So a lot of different variables, but it is part of the job.
I knew it.
Saying no is like I said, is definitely an art. And I think, you know, there's graceful ways to go about it. And, you know, you know, the other thing too, I will say, is that, you know, most of the time, though, when you're saying no, there's usually an element of
sure.
The reality of, like, it's, you know, oftentimes not necessarily have only to do with like the material. It could be something with the availability or going out of town or what have you,
or the budget,
of course, that's a big component. Yeah. And oftentimes, you know, it's not only about the rate, you know, for that cinematographer or the editor, what have you, but it's also, what does it mean in terms of what, the crew they get, what's going to be on the screen. Is this, you know, realistic budget for what the appetite is for the script, you know, all those things.
None of your clients want to shoot my vertical iPhone movie for some reason. Your list of clients is just insane. People that have shot just like, you know, the coolest indie films or like the biggest, you know, studio films. Like, at some point, if someone calls you for like a Larry Fong, you know, who shot like Super 8 and 300 and Watchmen. Do you say like, well, you know, I don't know if you can get him, but I have someone that's kind of like the young Larry Fong on my roster too, you know, the up and coming. Like, do you offer kind of alternatives too, like when producers are reaching out?
Absolutely. Yeah. If someone calls for a client and that client's not available or won't do it, and it's, a pass for them, and, the producer is interested in alternative ideas, then yes. But we do protect any incoming calls for clients. So like if someone calls about a specific client and they want to send a script and set up a meeting, that is protected for that client. So there are though times
you won't like switch where, them, right?
Yeah. No, yeah, them. Exactly. Unless they pass, they're not interested or unavailable. In which case, if they're unavailable, we'll still let them know that we got the call. And yeah, we, of course, we, like I said, we see ourselves as a resource. So if, again, if there's an opportunity, and the client that they called about is not available or not interested, then yeah, we're always willing to help.
Yeah. And by the way, I just noticed that you rep Radium Chung, who did shoot Tangerine on an iPhone.
So, yes.
Sure.
Indeed. And it's an amazing movie.
I'm curious about these meetings. Do you ever attend the meetings between like a director and a cinematographer, or do you just kind of set them up?
I never attend them. I help clients prep for them. So that means like I will give them as much insight as I have about what we know about the project, any personal history I may have with a director, producer, you know, all the people involved. And then also provide them with feedback in terms of like, if they're putting a presentation together, provide them with feedback of what I think works or doesn't work, things like that. Talk to them in general about the script.
Do you think a cinematographer needs to put together a presentation when they meet with the director? Or like, can you tell us a little bit about how to prep for that meeting?
These days, I think it is very important to put a visual presentation for a cinematographer. Same with, you know, goes for a production designer or a costume designer. I think it is now expected for any, you know, any HOD really to come in with a visual presentation. I think that's something that has become more or less standard. And I think it's always good to have in your back pocket to not only showcase your ideas, but also like your enthusiasm and your overall perspective on the project. I think that is something that's very important. The extent to which, you know, as far as like how elaborate the presentation is, will depend. I think, you know, everybody has a different approach of how they go about putting these presentations together. You know, I always say it's also good to have kind of two versions basically of a presentation. Let's say like you've pulled, you know, certain types of images. It's good to have a slightly different version as well, so that when you go into a meeting with a director and you're talking about the creative, if the images that you pulled out first aren't really in line with what the director is seeing, it's nice to have also another set of images to say, hey, you know, there's this also alternative way to go about it. What do you think? And then it becomes more of a dialogue, because filmmaking, obviously, as you all know, it's very much about collaboration. And so I think it's important to show to a director that A, you're listening and that you are malleable as far as like being able to take what the director is suggesting and be able to adapt and kind of interpret that in your own way. And that's, you know, that thing, obviously that's true collaboration right there. So those are some of the tidbits at least that we generally give to clients whenever they're preparing for an interview.
If I'm interviewing an editor to work on a movie, what do I ask them? Like with cinematography and production design, it's so easy to look at things. And I guess with an editor, you can like maybe talk about your favorite scenes or rhythm and pacing. But what are some good questions to ask an editor?
Well, I think as far as when you're talking to an editor, you're really talking about an overall story. So I think when you're having a discussion about the script, I think the things that are important and that, you know, we talk to our editor clients a lot is, what are the emotional beats? So it's the questions of like, what did you connect with emotionally, you know, and why, and sort of how do you think you could enhance that? You know, what are the important components sort of to creating the emotional impact you want? So it's really talking about the story overall and who the characters are, what are the themes of the story. And also, very importantly, talking about the tone and the type of tone that you're trying to create. And then asking the editor of, based on the script, like, A, what is your interpretation? And then, you know, talking about what you're trying to accomplish and getting their take on how they think they would go about accomplishing that tone.
That's interesting. Matt, have you interviewed like editors or DPs? Like, when do you ask them? When you,
yeah, you know, it's funny. I think that so much of my early career was a lot of matchmaking. It was always like, oh, this is the editor that did the last sketch that we shot of this series, so they're going to cut this one. And, you know, you either click with them or you don't, and you just kind of like, you're cycling through that. Coming up in sketch, you just get to work with a lot of different crew members all the time, and sometimes you're bringing in your own people and sometimes not. So it was very rare that I would do an interview, because it was always like, oh, just we already have a working relationship. And if I was curious about someone, you have kind of like small, low stakes environments to see if the collaboration is a fit or not, which is what I like about commercials. But there's just this extra layer of client facing affability and presentational elements that don't guide my decision making, but like, we all have met great editors who are a little grumpy and wear sweatpants a lot, and they are awesome, but also like, you can't, you know, session with them.
Right,
with
they don't like notes.
Yeah. They don't like, they roll their eyes or whatever. And, you know, I think Oren, you and I have careers because we're good at not rolling our eyes and turning bad notes into decent ones, perhaps. Right. So to me, it's interesting to try and basically shotgun all of the tiny little social moments that you have shooting with someone for a couple days or over the course of a few months at different times, or having coffee with them or lunch with them, into a single meeting, right? Like, if you're going to go shoot a feature with someone, that you're really in the trenches with them. You have to assume that any person that you're meeting with, any person that Louisa is repping, they're already awesome. They can do the job. So much of it to me is personal. It's right, like, right. Oh, do you get it? Do mm-hmm. I want to spend 18 hours a day with you for the next couple months? That's the question, you know, like, are you going to roll your eyes at me when I ask something dumb? Do you know what I mean? Or like, try out something that's physically impossible, or like, suggest something that you already tried, you know, all of those things are the questions for me. Or like, or get super excited at something silly, you know what I mean? Like, I can't tell you how many times I'll be like, let's get some plexiglass and shoot blood at the lens, or like, you know, kind of like those silly film schooly ideas. I still get really excited about that stuff sometimes. And like, a DP who's there to like roll with it and plus it, that's what I'm looking for, basically. So,
yeah. But I feel like of your clients, I mean, you're kind of, you know, probably one of your more famous clients is Shane Hurlbut, who, you know, has shot giant movies, famously Terminator Salvation, but also is the type of guy that would get the plexiglass and the ketchup bottle, you know, like, he's like, I feel like a lot of these DPs, especially like at the top levels, like, still love that like kind of DIY mentality of like, let's grab the camera and get mm-hmm. in the car and shoot that thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And Matt, to your point, I couldn't agree more. I do think personality match and just shared sensibility, I think, is a huge component. You know, whenever you're thinking about hiring a DP or editor or production designer, I think that's a huge component. And also, frankly, actually for us too, whenever we're thinking sure. about bringing on a client, it's about the talent, of course, but it's also about the personality. And as you said, you know, as a director, you're spending, you know, months on end, especially with an editor. You know, for us, it's similar. It's like if we're going to be working with a client, hopefully for years to come, like we want to be enjoying the conversations we're having. Personality is definitely, I think, a very big component, and shared sensibility and shared way of seeing the world, and then also just approaching storytelling, I think, is definitely an important component whenever you're hiring.
Yeah, I think so. Your client David Rom, who shot my first movie, he mm-hmm. when I interviewed him, it was like I'd say a B- at best interview. but
Oren, how old were you when you were shooting this movie, too? Out of curiosity, just as a
maybe 28, so like yeah. 2 years
yeah.
ago.
Yeah.
he was like, I had a couple friends, a friend Tim Cahill that had just made a short that was at Sundance that David shot. And then the editor, Matt Barber, who's been on our podcast many times, another friend that had worked with David or knew David, they all were like, if I could pick anyone in the world to shoot my next short, my next movie, my next thing, it would be David Rom. And it was like, they were just so enamored by him that even though our interview was, and it was like my first feature, kind of first big project, I didn't really know what to ask a DP. It was just like off the recommendations and kind of my strategy when I'm really fairly lost in terms of like how to do the interview from the director's side is I always just like look at their work, you know, look at their shorts, look at their movies, look at the trailers and just ask them like, so tell me about this, you know, where'd you film it? How, what were like the hard parts? What was fun? How'd you do this car crash? You know? And I feel like those are the super easy conversations to have. And then they'll start saying like, oh, that night was crazier. And this director was crazier. This director was amazing. You know, like, and you start learning things. And David Rom, like I kind of famously, I've said this on the podcast before, told me like on the first day of our prep, he's like, you're not going to be one of those directors that just everything is about the movie and you expect everyone from like the PAs to the grips to the electricians to all only care about your movie because it's your movie. Like you're going to have some perspective on what this means to the different people on set. And he kind of taught me like a little bit about that. Cause I think, you know, you come from the film school mentality which I didn't go to film school, but that kind of DIY mentality where everyone is just going to like kill themselves for this project. And when you get to like more serious projects, it's like people don't want to kill themselves. You know, they want to do good work and they want you to be prepared. So you're not wasting their time on set, like trying to figure out what you're doing, you know? And he also, I also remember when we did a scene that we changed location last minute and I was like, he's like, hey, how are we shooting this? And I said, two shot and the, you know, over the shoulders. And he said to me, the two shot is the most boring shot in cinema. Like
hard disagree, but his point was right. His point was right.
Sketch Matt. You know, in commercials, a lot of times we travel and, you know, when we're lucky, we get to bring our DPs. I've never personally been able to bring a production designer with me. And a lot of times when you're shooting in other places, you kind of want a local person that knows the locations, that knows the crew, that knows like where to get the stuff. And there's the advantages, I think, of a local production designer. And so I have had to interview a lot of them. And recently I interviewed two in New York. First one was real nuts and bolts. You know, I talked to her about like the colors and the things that we wanted to have in our location and how we wanted to dress the set. And she was, you know, very much like budget conscious, you know, like, you know, well, we might be able to afford this. I still haven't talked to the producer. We'll figure this out, like what we can do. And the other production designer, who is a much more veteran production designer that's been kind of doing it for a very long time, just came right out of the gate with like, I love the idea behind this. And this is a commercial, you know, a 15-second commercial. Like, I love the idea here. Like, I totally connect to it. And it's like so relevant. And he just like instantly won me over by talking about the ideas of the commercial and like kind of making the logistics very much like not something I should worry about. And obviously at some point, like everything does come to like time and money. But in that first conversation, it's just like awesome to have a DP, a production designer, an editor, whether it's a 15-second commercial or a, you know, 20-episode TV show, just come and talk to you about like why they're excited about the things and, you know, mm-hmm. or even the things that they think they have some ideas on how they could be better. Because, you know, not everyone is pitching on things that they instantly fall in love with, you know.
I'm curious for our listeners at home who are maybe cinematographers, maybe they're editors. They're basically people who are curious to become repped by you or someone like you. What does an ideal early career client look like to you? And how do you source those people? How do you discover them in the first place?
The things that we look for are very much a point of view and consistency in the work, meaning when I look at the work, and this is specifically in regards to cinematographers, like the work has to be consistent in terms of the use of lighting and camera movement and things like that for me to be able to identify a certain point of view. So from a logistical standpoint, we do need an existing buyer base of some sort. It can be a smaller buyer base, but say you're coming out of commercials and music videos. So you should, you know, if you have a good amount of buyers, meaning directors, producers that are coming to you asking to book you, then there's pre-existing business there we can build on. Again, I wouldn't put a quantity on that, but if we need something to build off of.
You're saying that they have to be working. Like you can't start Correct. Someone from scratch. Like if someone's like, hey, Louisa, student loans are rough. Help me out. They're probably not in the right position to
No. Yeah, I would say. Yeah. No, I mean, if you're coming fresh out of like film school, but you don't have much of a body of work, let's say you've only shot like a couple of short films, that will be really hard for us to work with. Again, an existing body of work to work with, and again, repeat business to a certain extent that we can expand upon. You know, it could also be, you know, having had like a couple of features under your belt. It's obviously helpful if those features have gone to well-known mm-hmm. festivals. That certainly helps. There's not really necessarily like a criteria that we strictly follow, because again, everyone's path is different, but an existing, like I said, buyer base is definitely important because we need something to build off of.
Right. That's interesting. I've never heard that term before.
Yeah, it's so flattering / kind of out of body to be referred to as a buyer. Do you know what I mean? Like yeah. As writer directors, I think of a buyer as a totally different person than like, you know, when I text my friend like, hey, are you available for this job? You know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's more of a, I would say, a business term.
Sure.
And again, that's more of a way to kind of simplify a combination of like relationships, so to speak, that one might have. So, but you get the idea.
So you've recently started repping directors. Can you tell us a little bit about like how that works? Are you getting them jobs? Are you mainly doing negotiating for contracts that their buyer base is already coming for? Like, tell us, you know, a lot of our listeners are directors. Mm-hmm. Like, tell us mm-hmm. about what you do for directors. And like, if directors even need an agent, or like, do they only need an agent at a certain point in their career? Like, can you tell us a little bit about that?
It depends on sort of where you are in your career. I mean, we have some directors, for example, like Lena Sokovska, who is super talented. She's very talented commercial director who is now transitioning to narrative. And when you're making that transition, there's definitely a lot of legwork that needs to be done as far as expanding your network. And so part of that is, you know, setting up general meetings, helping her develop her own projects that she wants to direct, helping to take those out, and, you know, fostering new relationships for her and trying to, you know, find new opportunities. It really depends on sort of where the client's coming from, like what their background is, what their experience level is.
Cool. And you specialize in features though, right? At WPA?
Yes, my specialty is features. I do cover Netflix 1 hour shows as well, but 99% of my time is spent on features.
I'm curious about what drew you to being an agent in the first place, actually, because you've got like a really deep background in terms of, you know, trying your hand at a handful of things. Walk us through just kind of like the quick story of how you became an agent and why.
The simple answer is I fell into it. I went to USC Film School and thought I wanted to direct, as many do. As they do. and directed some shorts and whatnot and really enjoyed that process. So I always had passion for storytelling and appreciation for the whole process, you know, the whole production process, the post process, all of it. And, you know, I realized when I was exiting film school is that obviously I needed to get a job. It wasn't going to be a job as a director, at least right away from film school. So my idea was, well, I should try different things and basically see what I like. And then that led to me working commercial production and gaining a lot of experience as far as like understanding how the sets run and so forth, but ultimately decided I didn't want to stay in commercials because it was, you know, a little bit too far away from the actual storytelling for me. Then I pivoted and thought, I was like, well, I should get experience working in an agency because mm-hmm. it's a great background to have regardless of what you do, because you get to be exposed to, you know, who is making the projects and understanding kind of like how the whole machine works. And so I went to Paradigm, started to work there as an assistant in the production department. And then that's where I ended up meeting actually a lot of my colleagues that I still work with today. While I was at Paradigm, again, a lot of my colleagues that I work with still today, like I saw how they were all working and the care and thought they put in into agenting. And I saw a rewarding side to being an agent, that it mm-hmm. wasn't just transactional, but that you could make a difference in the clients' careers, and you can influence sort of how things, you know, happen for them in terms of mm-hmm. being able to open doors for them, give them guidance of like what to do in different situations and, you know, what projects to take or not to take, and being that sounding board for them. So that ultimately is what appealed to me, because prior to that, I very much had the notion that, you know, agents, you know, again, were more or less car salesmen, and that didn't appeal to me. But I saw the opportunity to make a difference. And that's, again, that's the why. And that's why I do it. I think that's why we all collectively do what we do at WPA. And it really has become my calling and something that I'm really passionate about. And I love doing every day. And I think it definitely obviously makes a big difference.
To me, being an agent seems like a really awesome job, but just like so difficult. Like, and also like kind of like a feast or famine type of mm-hmm. deal. Like being an actor, like either you are at the top and you have clients like yours, or you're just like every day, like the guy, the koala bear from Sing, Matthew McConaughey's character, if you guys have seen that animated movie, DreamWorks. He's just like mm-hmm. running around like, hey, let me rep you, you know. I'll make you a deal, I'll get, you know. And it's just like, it's just, that's why to me it's like so scary. But once you've kind of established yourself, it seems like a really rewarding job, because you get to work with super talented creative people and help them and be involved in so many projects. You know, I feel like it's one of the few jobs that someone, you know, that one person can touch so many different projects because you have, you know, a lot of clients. Can you give me like a rough rate of like, or a rough range of like kind of what an inexpensive cinematographer costs per day to like an expensive cinematographer? Like I know kind of my perspective, like what I think it is, but I'm curious if there is, you know, like in the below the line representation handbook, there's like, you know, a range.
Sure. And we're talking about commercials or we're talking about
like
narrative.
Let's say I wanted to hire a cinematographer to prep for a week, shoot for 2 days and shoot for 2 days. Let's say something like that. Like, you know, what are kind of the ranges that.
I would say, obviously, you know, it always depends on the person's expertise, and then of course, like also relative usually to the budget as well. You know, on a low budget commercial, and if you're starting out, you know, in the commercial space, you're probably looking at like $1,000 a day on a higher end commercial for a DP. I mean, you're talking about 5,000, you know, potentially higher, you know, if we're talking about award-winning cinematographers. So, you know, it's a 5,000 a day and above, you know, at that level.
And so let's say that's awesome. That's kind of, you know, I work with some producers that say, you know, like, is this project the $2,500 ADP or is this the $5,000 ADP or the $1,000 ADP, you know, and in right. their mind, there is a difference between, you know, the, mm-hmm. like the final product is different, but also like a $5,000 ADP probably needs, you know, more support. Like you, first of all, it's going to probably be a union shoot, you know, and it's mm-hmm. probably, they're going to need an operator and they're going to need a DIT and they're going to need like these other things and camera prep. And how does that, so let's say you hire someone that's, let's say $3,000 a day, just to throw out a number there. And there's a week of prep. How, like, is that $3,000 for a shoot day or how does it work in terms of like the, how much at the end of the day does the, do they get?
Yeah. Let's, what's the project fee versus,
I mean, typically our clients working at the same daily rate for prep and shoot, you know, mm-hmm. unless there's, you know, some exceptions that needs to be made and it's a project they have to do. There might be some concessions made. But typically, it's the same rate for prep and shoot.
And so if it's a scout, that's just like 1 hour of the day or something, they would get their full day rate for that.
I mean, if it's literally an hour, there perhaps could be a conversation, had about like what, you know, what that looks like, monetarily. Typically, like I said, it is usually like the same daily rate. So, you know, and also typically it's one of those things sometimes, even like we're talking about like travel days, you know, mm-hmm. you know, travel days, generally speaking, are also at the same rate. But usually what happens is like, you're not just traveling, you're also like coming to wherever you're going and then you're mm-hmm. scouting or you're having meetings or what have you. So, we ask all those details and again, we assess things. And then, again, it's a case by case basis.
Yeah. I like to corner my DPs on the airplane. Mm-hmm. Just, shot lists with them.
Yeah. I, you know, it's for a long time, I, never wanted to know what anyone was making because like DPs are a great example where it's like, oh, your day rate is less than my day rate, but if you figure in all of the unpaid time I have on phone calls and pitching and all that stuff, you know, you start doing the math and you're like, dang, maybe I should have been a DP instead of a director.
Yeah, I know. It's, you never want to know as a director that the DP is just making way more money.
Yeah, you just see, podcast. It's like, oh, wait, you own that Alexa? That's like a... It's like $150,000 for the gear you got right there, buddy. You know, so
how does gear play into it? Does that usually go through you, or would that be like a separate deal between the producers and the DPs if they own like the camera package or they own some other gear?
That's a good question. It's usually a separate deal that we typically don't handle. So that's usually between the DP and the producer. Mm-hmm. So we have some DPs that own equipment that is at a camera rental house. So sometimes, you know, it's a conversation of, you know, a deal to be made through the rental house to rent their gear. So yeah, that's not generally something that we negotiate. We may have a discussion with the producer about bringing our client's gear onto the project, but we don't actually handle that part of the negotiation.
Right. Because I guess I sometimes, you know, especially on the lower budget things, it's like, hey, I know the rate's a little low, but we are going to get, you know.
Yeah, we're going to rent your camera. Yeah. So don't worry. Yeah. Yeah.
And it is a little bit unfair, obviously.
Sure. Because,
they should be getting paid for both things.
They did invest tens of thousands of dollars on a camera. Yeah.
And then, so I'm assuming for features, it would be a little less expensive, right? On a day rate. Like if you're shooting for like an indie feature for 25 days, let's say, that same DP that's getting $5,000 a day on a commercial probably is not getting $5,000 a day for like a month of prep and a month of shooting, are they?
I would say yes, for the most part. Yeah, that would be very, very difficult, I think, for any production to pay that amount on a small budget indie. So yeah, typically, again, in the indie space, again, it varies based on the budget. And also a lot of times it will also vary in terms of like how much is being spent on the cast, mm-hmm. you know, versus how much is being and you know, producer director fees versus like the production budget. But yes, you're correct. Like, you know, on an indie, certainly like on a smaller indie, it will be closer to like, you know, $1,000 a day. Again, it's going to vary on, you know, the size of the budget, whatnot. So, and who it is. So, you
and
know,
does ownership or like points play into it at all? Like if, you know, on an indie film, do you ever negotiate that?
Yes, we do negotiate that. Typically it is more on, much smaller budget films that cannot afford mm-hmm. the rate the client is used to getting. So we do negotiate that as far as like back end points or perhaps like a sales bonus or something like that. That's definitely something that we talk to producers about.
While we're just in the nitty gritty on money, there's got to be, especially for your emerging clients or younger clients, people who don't have as many credits as some of the people on your roster, there's got to be circumstances where the money that the client is taking home isn't really the incentive, that the feature is going to be really special. It has the opportunity to pop. They're really going to get to show a different side of their creative personality or whatever it is. They're creatively driven to want to do this movie.
Yeah, it's got some interesting talent attached.
They're not really making a ton of money. They're not making much money at all, let's say, right? There's got to be a calculus for the agency, because if your client is making peanuts, then you're making 10% of a peanut, right? So, but at the same time, you're still invested in their career in the long term. You know, walk us through, I guess, maybe just like your attitude about that sort of work, presuming that you're on the same page with your client that like, you do think it's worthwhile creatively to do this and good for a good career decision, basically, that it's not going to be a embarrassment or a waste of their time in some way.
Mine and you know, WPA's philosophy has always been follow the art and the money will follow. So we're always in favor of clients doing artistic work that they're passionate about. So regardless of how much it's going to pay. So if the client is passionate about doing, you know, a $1 million movie that's going to pay peanuts. And we all collectively think, yeah, that's a great move because the story has a lot of potential. This director has a lot of potential. You know, the client is over the moon about the project. We wholeheartedly support that. So that has always been our mentality. And I think it's something that is a very important component because ultimately, like if you do good work and you making decisions in an educated, smart way about you're following your instincts, you're following the creative, that's going to continue to progress your career forward. If you're only following the money, it's going to be a lot of the same. And ultimately, you create a career that is likely going to be less fulfilling and less curated in terms of, you know, your entire body of work. So, so yeah, absolutely. Like, truthfully too, as far as like when you're talking about quality of scripts, really small independence is where a lot of the best stories are. I mean, we talk about that a lot. And that's, again, one of the reasons why, as I mentioned, like I love going to festivals because a lot of the films that I see, for example, at Sundance tend to be my favorite movies that year. So usually some of the best creative is in the independent films. And again, those don't pay a lot.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks for being open about that. Really the reason we're asking about this, aside from just us, you know, kind of being curious for ourselves, is like, I think there is just a fear, like there is just an assumption that people like can't afford to get this great, you know, or that, but like nuts and bolts, actually, maybe they can't, you know, they have $100,000 to shoot something for a day or two, and they can probably get, you know, one of your clients to shoot, you know, like a $1 million movie, if it's the right script, if it's this, you know, then like, I don't know. It's something that I personally like struggle with, which is sometimes like, oh, this is a small project. Like, can I ask this really acclaimed person to be a part of it? And what I'm finding is a lot of times, yeah, you know, you can. And obviously the worst thing you can hear is no, no, we can't do that. But you can also hear yes. Like, I appreciate you talking to us about how agents can be, you know, resources, obviously for their clients, but also for like the directors and the filmmakers and the people that come to you to work with your clients. Hopefully people learned something from this interview. Thanks so much for talking to us.
I hope so too.
Do you have a minute to hang out with us to do an unpaid endorsement?
Sure.
Unpaid endorsements.
My unpaid endorsement is the GQ write-up of James Cameron called The Return of James Cameron, Box Office King. It's like a kind of a long form piece about, you know, his career. He's got the new Avatar sequel coming out. And, you know, it's kind of in the midst of early reactions to Avatar and kind of this new emerging narrative that, like, ha ha ha, we all thought that James Cameron was insane for spending so much time and so much money trying to make these movies. But the guy never misses. He's going to, you know, top the box office again. You know, I love Terminator 2. I really love Terminator 2.
Oh, it's my favorite movie of all time.
So good. Don't get me started. I guess I'm excited for Avatar 2 is what I'm saying. And no matter what, you know, there's so much to learn from that guy. He's so specific and singular and competent across the board. You know, they say that James Cameron can do any person's job on set kind of better than most people doing them. And so, you know, I guess he's like maybe a little surly sometimes, but there's a lot to admire about him. And it's a great piece that addresses that, asks him about that. He kind of confronts it, digs in a little bit on the myth of James Cameron on the eve of this new movie coming out. So the Return of James Cameron, Box Office King. I can't wait to hear what you all think of Avatar 2.
So my unpaid endorsement is this amazing film that's coming out on December 23rd, and that's called Living. Oliver Hermanus directed it, WPA client Jamie Ramsey. shot it, and I got to see it at Cameramage Cinematography Film Festival last month. And I think it's an amazing film. It's very heartwarming and aspirational. Talks a lot about the choices we make in our life and what we decide to spend basically our life on, in terms of what is important and, you know, who is important and how the decisions we make ultimately impact also the experience, the life experience we have. So definitely highly recommend watching it. It's it stars Bill Nye, and it's a beautiful, masterful piece of filmmaking, and I think it's definitely worth seeing.
Kaplan, what you got?
The podcast I'm just like so obsessed with, and I apologize if I've talked about this already, but is Conan Needs a Friend. It's a Conan O'Brien podcast. I think it's been on forever. Did I talk about it already, man?
Yes, you did.
I did. Sorry. I just like listen to it every day because I was like a real political podcast junkie for a while. First, I was like a filmmaking podcast junkie, then a political podcast junkie, and now I just like want to like laugh and not worry about things. And it's just, I mean, it's so good. There's an app. It's okay. It's called Photo Circle. And I just used it on my last shoot. And it's basically like, you know, if everyone on the production is like taking photos, behind the scenes photos, and clients and agency and whoever, it's like an Apple iCloud album, but it's like forever. You don't have to have.
So everyone uploads their photos to.
Yeah. So everyone uploads their photos from their phone to the Photo Circle group. And you can comment on it, but you also get, like, if you all go to an event together, you make this photo circle group, and then you get everyone's photos. So anyway, those are my things.
Awesome.
Well, awesome. If we want to learn more about you, Louisa, are you on Instagram? Should we go to the WPA website? What's the best way to find out more about you and what you're doing?
I would say go to the WPA website. That's WPA.com. I would go there because we were very active in terms of promoting clients' work, and you can kind of see the latest updates there. And I'm also on Instagram, Louisa Vick, if you'd like to find me there too.
Well, you can tweet us, Instagram us, all of that stuff. If you have any questions about the show, want to follow up in any way, at Just Shoot It Pod across all social media. You can email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com, and you can hit me up on social media at Mr. Matt Enlow across everything.
And I'm at Smitey Pileg on Twitter. I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Our producer is Tyler Smalls. And the music that you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And we'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Bye.